Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord, a series of conversations on sports and culture with various fans, friends, and media personalities. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting viewmyseats.com. Thanks for listening.
Ben Rothenberg is a contributing writer for the New York Times, now overseas preparing to cover the upcoming French Open. All right, Ben, before we get into the French Open, let's actually start with how a tennis reporter like yourself ends up in Vienna covering the 2015 European Song Contest.
Yeah, no, I've loved Eurovision for a long time. They don't really have a whole lot to do with each other. I guess tennis is pretty European at this point, but something about it is not that different, I guess. I mean, people represent their countries and have, you know, a spotlight on them. It's a sort of an individual sport as it goes musically. And I don't know, pretty much make anything into a competition and I'll be happy with it. I'm a competitive person and love watching other people do the same. And all the nonsense that goes on with this contest makes it a lot of fun too.
Okay. For those of us who aren't in the know, primarily all of America, you're going to have to explain what the heck is going on right now with this, with Eurovision. It's a huge, enormous deal. Maybe I'm selling Americans short, but it's a huge deal, right?
Yeah. It's pretty shocking that it's not on American TV anywhere, considering we have like 300 channels of cable that would be seemingly have plenty of real estate for it. Basically it's an annual song competition that's been on for 60 years. In Europe, 60th anniversary this year, and pretty much every country sends an original song of no more than 3 minutes, and then they all go on stage and perform, and usually have all sorts of ridiculous gimmicks, try to get themselves to stand out, and at the end, people vote for whoever the winner is, and the winner hosts the next year. So Austria won last year, and so it's in Vienna this year. A lot of Europeans, because of the gimmicks and everything, they sort of mock it, but once it comes around every year, people get really invested in it. It's by far the most watched non-sporting event in television anywhere each year.
Is there anything that you would equate it to in American pop culture? Are we talking like an American Idol? Are we talking The Voice? America's Got Talent? What are we talking here?
Yeah, like when American Idol was a really, really big deal, like 10, 12 years ago, that, but sort of multiplied times a little bit of Olympics, I guess, just because there's national pride and countries going against each other. I mean, you can slap sort of a country onto anything and people will get invested. Because, I mean, even if you don't know anything about the singer, you have a preconceived notion of, you know, Russia and if you want them to win or lose when they're on stage. So all the sort of national pride, like, dislike things get revved up into it. And it's a pretty messy scene sometimes, but a lot of fun.
Who is, from what you've seen so far, who is your favorite to take home 2015 Eurovision?
I think it's going to be Sweden this year. Sweden's obviously a big pop music country and they just take it a lot more seriously right now than a lot of the other countries, and they unabashedly want to win. They don't have any of those hang-ups about being too cool for it, like the United Kingdom tries to pretend it is. So I think they're my pick, and they're the betting favorite right now, too, but not by a huge margin. Italy also has a pretty good shot.
Well, what about any popular underdogs, perhaps a country that people are pulling for?
Serbia was, I think, the one that really impressed people in the first semifinal. Serbia was like a 200-1 chance of winning it all, going into the semifinal, coming out of it, they were 12-1. So I think they won a lot of people over. It's a really energetic song in a year with a kind of a lot of dreary ballads, so it stands out pretty nicely.
All right, well, now is a good time to segue into the purpose of our conversation, which is tennis after all. And yep, you mentioned underdogs, and it's 2015, and the French Open is a few days away here. Is it fair to say that Rafael Nadal is an underdog heading into the 2015 French Open?
I mean, strictly speaking, absolutely, because he's not the favorite. I mean, the favorite from all oddsmakers is Novak Djokovic. Novak Djokovic believes he's the favorite. That's not a unanimous opinion by any stretch, but on paper, Djokovic is the guy to beat. I mean, obviously, all eyes will be on Nadal, and when Nadal loses at the French Open, it will still be a seismic event, no matter how expected or not it was going in. Underdog is a fair label, which seems pretty surprising for a guy who's won 9 in the last 10 years, but his last 12 months has been incredibly shaky by his standards.
Yeah, so heading into the French Open, you know, it's he obviously hasn't been performing up to how he normally does heading into French Open as far as on other clay court events. Is it fair to say that we've seen the last of Rafa Nadal as the dominant clay court player perhaps ever?
Well, I think it depends on what dominant means. I mean, the bar he set for himself was so absurdly high. I mean, he had a couple years where he swept everything. He would go to all three Masters events and win them all. and win Barcelona and then the French Open also, and just run the table. And I don't think we're going to see that again. I just think that with his getting older and slowing down significantly, because people have been predicting it for a while, you know, the way he plays, he would always have more wear and tear on his body than your average player at his age, which is just 29 now. I think is definitely past his peak, but that doesn't mean there's nothing left for him. I do think the end will come more quickly for him than it did for like a Federer who plays a more effortless style and had always had better health luck throughout his career. But it's not over, but I think the Rafael Nadal of old, the complete unstoppable force, is probably a thing of the past.
You're going to have to explain to me, Ben, in tennis, does seeding really matter when it comes to these majors? Because in other sports, you know, we have the NBA and NHL playoffs taking place right now, and seeding does determine, obviously, home court advantage, home ice advantage, things like that. Does it really matter when it comes to tennis? Because Rafa Nadal is the seventh seed heading into the French Open. Does that really matter at all when it comes to major tennis championships?
It will matter if the draw... where the draw puts him, basically, because as a 5-8 seed, he's going to be drawn against one of the top four in the quarterfinals. And if it's number four, Berdych, then it's not really a big deal, because I think that's, no one really thinks that Berdych is a huge favorite to beat Nadal. But if it happens to be Djokovic or maybe even Andy Murray that he's drawn against, that's a huge deal, because it means that one of Djokovic and Nadal will not make it to the semifinals, which is a huge shock of the French Open with how those two are regarded, them being the top two favorites to win the whole tournament. So the draw matters more than the seeds, really. But the draw is determined by the seeding. So we'll see on Friday where that puts Djokovic. Where that puts Nadal. If he winds up in the Berdych quarter or even in the Federer quarter on the opposite half from Djokovic, it's kind of a moot point. But if he's in that same quarter, it's a huge, huge storyline with those two getting to meet relatively early in the event.
You mentioned Andy Murray. He's performing quite well on the clay this season. Is that all attributed to his coach, Amélie Mauresmo?
It's a lot of things. I think the progress with Mauresmo, Murray just seems very, very content and happy with Amélie. Has a lot of respect for her, and they seem to have a really, really good, positive relationship. So that's obviously good. She was a decent clay court player, but always really struggled with the French Open, actually, with those sort of home court nerves. So I'm not sure she's exactly a French Open whisperer, but... he's doing well, and it's a lot of things. He's healthy. He is also just at a time when the other guys aren't doing well. The only other player who's really playing his best of the top guys right now is Djokovic. So Murray's taking advantage of that dip from Nadal. He absolutely crushed him in the Madrid final, and we didn't see that coming. And so he's going into the French Open now undefeated, even though he'd only won just these two clay court tournaments this year, are the only titles he's ever gotten on the surface. So it's an interesting time for Murray, for sure. And he's definitely in the conversation, but still probably a step behind Djokovic, for sure, when it comes to French Open potential. Although it's totally possible that he could make it to a final, at least.
Novak Djokovic, who's the top seed but has never won a French Open, and Roger Federer has only won one French Open. What is it about clay courts that make it so difficult for some of these really, really excellent players, all-time great players, to succeed on the different surface?
For those two in particular, actually, I just think the answer is as simple as Rafael Nadal. I mean, Roger Federer actually has the second most French Open wins in terms of just match wins of any player all time. He just happens to be behind Nadal and ran into Nadal over and over and over again in the later stage of the tournament and couldn't break through to a title. I mean, he's easily the best clay court player to have only won one French Open. And Novak Djokovic, with all the wins he's had over Nadal at smaller Masters events and other clay titles he's won, Djokovic is probably the best clay court player to never win the title. So really it's a bad luck of timing for these guys more than the surface itself. Murray doesn't really always have the patience to grind out the clay court rallies or just sort of know when to strike. His movement wasn't always natural on the surface. So he's somebody who I think has more real problems on the clay that aren't just about at all. But for those other two guys, it's just about that same guy hogging all the trophies this last decade.
So if it weren't for Nadal, we're talking about Federer and Djokovic at this point having multiple French Open championships, your opinion.
I think so, for sure, for sure.
Is there a player on the men's side outside of the top eight who you wouldn't be surprised if they were there in, say, the semifinals?
The one just, to cheat a little bit, the one just outside the top eight, number nine, is Stan Wawrinka, who did really well in Rome, made the semifinals, beat Nadal pretty handily after Nadal kind of collapsed in the first set tiebreak, was up 6-2 and lost it. Wawrinka is playing well right now. He's playing a warm tournament in his home area of Geneva in French-speaking Switzerland, so it should give him some good momentum coming in from this week, and he's definitely somebody to look for. Otherwise, on the men's side, there just aren't as many outsiders who really can make a relevant dent, it seems like, especially on clay. It's just so top-heavy, and there's such a big gap compared to especially the women's side, where it's a little bit more of a free-for-all, and anybody can have a bad day. The men at the top have been much, much more solid. One other person who I might mention, just would be a very tough draw for Nadal that he could get as early as the third round. Seated around 30 right now is Fabio Fognini, who already managed to beat him twice this year on clay. So that's the one real name I have circled as somebody who could give Nadal big trouble in the first week.
Is there any point talking at all about any Americans on the men's side?
John Isner's actually had a pretty decent clay court season. He's lived up to his seeding or better at the Masters events, lost twice to Nadal and once to Thomas Berdych after holding match point. So he's doing pretty well. I mean, obviously, it depends on we as Americans, we're used to winning everything and aren't going to be happy with, you know, a guy who's just kind of verge of top 10 and has an outside shot to make the quarterfinals. That's maybe doesn't reach the, you know, cusp of relevance for Americans, but he's doing better. Jack Sock has had some okay results. He won a tournament in Houston on clay, but American clay plays a lot different than European clay, so I'm not sure if it'll translate that relevantly. On the men's side, no. Women's side, obviously, Americans have a real contender, and Serena is a top seed and favorite. But on the men's side, it's a dark time, especially on clay. I wouldn't hold your breath.
No, it's something that even for casual fans of tennis, we know that men's American tennis is experiencing somewhat of a drought. I don't know how far back you can go, maybe since Andy Roddick retired, but everyone seems to have some sort of opinion as to why it is. What do you think it is, Ben, as far as why there hasn't been a more dominant American men's tennis player recently?
Well, I mean, I think the four guys right now, first of all, are incredibly good. And so there's a lot of countries that if you don't have one of those top four guys, you're not winning no matter what country you are. So it's a dry spell for a lot of people just because the wins have not been spread around at all. But also, I just think this current crop of American players is just not very deep, and I think the way that they were sort of trained in the post-Roddick era a little bit, I think people were taught a sort of serve-first mentality that also worked for Pete Sampras before that, and the game changed. I mean, the conditions slowed down quite a lot. Courts became slower. Balls became fluffier in an attempt to get rid of the sort of serve-robot style that Sampras had that took him to so many titles. The sport moved away from what were traditionally American strengths, and we haven't really evolved to keep up with that yet. There's a good group of teenagers coming up now who there are a lot of hopes on. There's just so many of them who are like some of the best in the world in the sort of 17, 18-year-old side. People like Francis Tiafoe, Stefan Kozlov, Michael Moe, Taylor Fritz, and a bunch of others. That there are so many names in there, you would hope that one of them would break through to be a top tenner at least. So the future is looking better, but I think just for a while, sort of European clay court style tennis wound up being style that fit the modern game.
Does it have anything to do with college tennis and that college programs don't prepare players to become professional tennis players? Because I don't understand do the best players, young players that are identified as potentially great tennis players, are they kind of selected out of the crowd and put into these academies, or do the best players go to college? How does it work exactly for good players in the United States?
The really, really best ones probably wind up going to some sort of academy and then turn pro without going to college. Some players also do go to an academy and then don't think they're ready to make it and go to a college after an academy. That's not unheard of. But for the most part, yeah, it's just those elite guys who do it. And there have been some Americans who probably could have benefited from college who didn't make the choice and burned out early on the tour, because you have to be really, really good, especially now. The game's gotten so physical that just a 17-year-old, 18-year-old body is not going to hold up against grown men the way that it used to on tour. You don't have even men's women's side, like, you know, in the 90s, Martina Hingis won 3 Grand Slams when she was 16. And there's just nothing like that now in the sport. Just the way the game has gotten to be so much more about strength, about conditioning, it just doesn't allow for these teenagers to break out early. And so a lot more American boys now are choosing college. It's a little bit of an insulation time. It's not sink or swim the way that pro tennis is, where you have to keep a ranking point to keep, you know, financially stable. Some of the top players, John Isner, Steve Johnson, two of the top American players right now, both spent 4 years of college, and it's served them pretty well.
Well, outside of Serena, who's an anomaly, would you say that there are more American women who are closer to winning major championships than there are men? And why is it? Why is it? Let's just assume that there are.
Yeah.
Why have women in the United States had more success as professional tennis players in recent history, taking Serena out of it, because that she's not even
right.
not even fair to put her in the equation. But why, in general, is the Americans deeper when it comes to the women's game than the men's game?
I think America, compared to the rest of the world, has a really good appreciation and infrastructure for women's sports. You know, girls are encouraged to play sports. It's not really a taboo thing for the most part at all. And so tennis is one of the premier options. I mean, just in terms of money, in terms of fame, the tennis players are some of the biggest female athletes in the world. All the top paid female athletes, the only ones who are in the top 100 overall of all athletes who are women are all tennis players. So I think it's much more of a common pick for an American girl to do that, whereas American boys obviously just have so many more sporting options. It can be a baseball player, football player, basketball player, you know, all the obvious more popular choices. So maybe if tennis can sort of go to some meetings of concerned parents where they're, you know, pulling kids out of youth football programs because of concussion concerns and put a racket in their hands, that might be a good way to bolster the numbers. But otherwise, it's just about the boys, generally, the talented athletes, not picking tennis first on the men's side.
Okay, Ben, I'll give you Serena versus the field. Who do you take?
I take the field just because Serena has not been that reliable at the French Open. It's always been her toughest slam. And even though she is number one, she hasn't won a title on clay this year. And she's had a few injury concerns off and on. Just not really sure that she's coming in totally clean. And even at the French Open, she did win it in 2013, but that was the only time she's made it even to the semifinals since 2003. So is she the overall favorite? Probably, but she's also definitely not a reliable person to be a runaway pick. So against the field, I would definitely take the field this year. But that might not be the case at Wimbledon, which is a much more suitable surface for her coming up later this summer.
You talk about how succeeding on clay almost doesn't just require a style of game, but it requires a temperament as well.
Yeah.
Does Serena have the right temperament for clay? You mentioned, you know, patience and finesse. Are those strengths of Serena's? And is that perhaps why, if they're not strengths, is that perhaps why she's only won one French Open slam?
They definitely didn't used to be strengths, that's for sure. Clay used to expose a lot of her impatience, a lot of her inconsistency, because a lot of times, and she'll admit this tactically early in her career, she wasn't that great because she was so fast and so strong that she didn't need to be, except for on clay, where other players could sort of, you know, expose her weaknesses a little bit more and slowly work their way into a match. But in the last 3-4 years, Serena's been pretty great on clay. She's won a lot of tournaments, just a couple early French Open losses that haven't quite gone her way. So I think it's more of a mental block than anything for Serena, because she's won so much everywhere else that where a tournament like the French Open has proven to be a weakness, it kind of gets in her head more than it might for other players.
Maria Sharapova is the defending champion. I'm wondering, who do the Paris crowds pull for during these French Opens? Is there a sense on the women's side of who the fan favorite is?
That's a good question. I think it's pretty varied just because there have been a lot of different players who've done well at the French Open the last few years on the women's side. It hasn't been one person since Justine Henin, who was a very stylish to watch Belgian player near France. She was the most popular player recently on the women's side, but she played her last French Open in 2010. So since then, there hasn't really been one clear fan favorite. I mean, people have definite respect for Serena and Sharapova, and Simona Halep made the final last year from Romania, got a lot of crowd support. She plays a fun game. But no, there isn't one clear darling on the women's side the way there is with Federer on the men's side, or even someone more French like Gael Monfils, who just captivates the crowd. Women don't really have that sort of player at this moment.
I'll ask you a similar question I asked you with the men's draw. Is there a woman outside the top eight who you wouldn't be surprised to see come the semifinals?
Yeah, there's a lot more on the women's side. I mean, like I said, the depth is better on the women's side in the sense that there's a lot more relevant players who can pull off big upsets. The two sort of people who stand out to me are this Swiss girl, Tamea Bachinski, who's had an incredible year and just really has been super steady. And clay is not maybe her best service, but she's been winning a huge number of matches, and she could definitely make some noise, plays a counter-punching style that should work well on clay. Another one is this sort of Spaniard, Garbiñe Muguruza, who plays a pretty powerful game, is young, made the quarterfinals last year and gave Sharapova one of her toughest tests of the tournament before losing in three long sets. So those would be my two names. And there's just a bunch more. We'll see how the draw shakes out that could be could be relevant on the women's side. It's a lot more of a free-for-all, for sure.
We're recording this on a Wednesday. When is the draw announced?
Friday, I believe. Friday afternoon.
Friday afternoon. So at this point, it sounds like a lot of your picks are going to be determined by the draw. But if I had to put you on the spot here, Ben, and say, okay, give us your, I don't want to say favorites, but your pick to win before the draws come out on this, the Wednesday, before the draw is announced on Friday.
I will pick Novak Djokovic for sure on the men's side. I just think that he's been steadier of the two, fewer question marks about him, and he has to start doing something wrong in order to not win the French Open. The way he's playing right now has been incredible, and if he keeps just maintains that level, I think he can kind of cruise to the title. On the women's side, I'll pick Maria Sharapova just because she's had fewer flameouts than Serena lately. If Serena and Maria happen to meet in the final, which is the only time they would meet as the number one and two seeds, I would take Serena easily, automatically. But in terms of getting to the final, Sharapova, I think, is sort of the steadier pick, so I'll pick her to win this.
If Djokovic were to win this year's French Open, that would give him the career Grand Slam. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
How many players in the history of professional tennis have won a career Grand Slam?
Off the top of my head, I'm not 100% sure. I think it's around 8 or 9. It's been a few more recently. I mean, we're in a pretty impressive era where I think a lot of it has to do with the grass and hard courts slowing down some, so the conditions are more similar. But there's been a lot of active players that have done it. I mean, women's side, Serena and Maria Sharapova have both done it, and on the men's side, Federer and Nadal have already done it. So if we have five active players, including Djokovic, that have won a career Grand Slam, that'd be pretty remarkable, because there's been a lot of great players in past eras of the game, like Pete Sampras, John McEnroe, that never really came close to doing it.
How great can Novak Djokovic be? Because, I mean, he is playing in the era of perhaps two of the all-time greatest tennis players, men's tennis players, in the history of tennis. Are we talking about perhaps one of the greatest players of all time? If he wins a French, goes on to win, it's expected to probably compete at least in several more years' worth of majors. I mean, are we talking about perhaps with Nadal, Federer, and Djokovic, three of the Mount Rushmore, the pantheon of all-time great men's tennis players?
I really think so. I mean, depending on how big your Rushmore is, there's no doubt that they're all on their way to at least being, say, top 10 men's players of all time, for sure, and we'll see how much more that list narrows the more Djokovic wins. The thing that Djokovic could do that would really set him apart is if they could get closer to winning a calendar Grand Slam, which hasn't been done in a long time. That's the excitement for Djokovic added on top of the career slam is that if he wins in Paris, he would get the first two legs, the Australian Open and the French Open, of the traditional calendar Grand Slam, winning all four in one calendar year. And nobody's pulled off even the first half of it since 1992 or 93, I think, when Jim Courier did it. So if he can pull off all four in one year, then it would really leap him up quite a few rungs on the ladder and put him in a pretty elite conversation. Definite Rushmore material, for sure.
Rushmore would only have four, so you went top 10, so that's
okay,
that's bigger. That's bigger. That's bigger than our Mount Rushmore.
We'll trim it down. So let's see. So Federer and Nadal are both Rushmore material. I guess Rod Laver. Depends on how far back you go. Bjorn Borg is in there too, and Djokovic would be up there though in that conversation. Once he gets to double digit Grand Slams, there's very, very few. And I think the modern game is so much deeper. Obviously, I'm younger, not old enough to remember people like Rod Laver from the 60s, but I think it's tougher now to win these Grand Slams, so I would be a little recency biased and put Djokovic on there as a Teddy Roosevelt or something.
As tennis fans, we have certainly been spoiled by the caliber of tennis players in recent years. Okay, last question for you, Ben. Appreciate you taking the time today. I know you're busy preparing for the French Open, but if, as a tennis reporter, someone who's fortunate enough to travel the world and watch these great tournaments in really fun places, you got to rank. This might be really unfair. I don't want to put you on the spot and have people upset at you for these rankings. But if you were to say, from the perspective of your favorite major cities, I'll give you Melbourne, Paris, London, and New York. As a reporter covering these events, could you rank those four places?
As cities or as tournaments? Because those are sort of different questions.
Oh, gosh. So I'm going to ask you as cities for a reporter covering the tournaments. Because that's a unique perspective.
Yeah. So I will pick, I think, Melbourne first. Melbourne just because it's the tournament site is closest to the downtown central business district, as they call it, of Melbourne, and so it's easy to go out there and find bars open and, you know, be able to walk back to wherever you're staying that year and find late night food.
That's a huge upset.
Huge thing. Whereas like Wimbledon, everything shuts because Wimbledon is a suburb, and a suburb that's, you know, very fancy and posh and tries to stay quiet and quaint even during the tournament. Everything will shut down at 11:30 at night or something, which is usually, especially being an American reporter with the time change, where I'm usually not always done that early because my editors are obviously still in the office much later than that, being 5 hours behind. So Wimbledon is tough for that. So if I had to rank in terms of just ease of use for a reporter, I would say Australian Open, French Open, Wimbledon, U.S. Open, I guess, and just in calendar order, too, just because U.S. Open, the commute to and from Queens every day, because most people stay in Manhattan, that gets pretty, that's a grind after, you know, day 13, 14 on the bus every day.
Wow, a couple of surprises there. U.S. Open last, Melbourne first. It sounds like you're primarily basing your rankings on how late the bars stay open.
Bars and food, just because, I mean, it's those are long days at Grand Slams, I mean, especially the ones with night sessions. I mean, you get there at like 10 a.m. before the first match starts and usually stay till 2. So we're just sort of creatures who just need to be fed and sleep every couple hours. More, it's about survival more than really enjoying the culture of the city.
It certainly wasn't a knock on Queens either.
No. Not never.
Well, Ben, I appreciate you taking the time today and enjoy the upcoming French Open.
Thank you very much.